Hello and welcome to the next 100 Days podcast. My name is Graham Arrowsmith.
And my name's Kevin Appleby. So, Graham, we're going to delve into pricing psychology today, which I think is going to be fascinating.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by pricing. I've come across people like Dan Kennedy, who always says put an extra note on your price and things like that. And you think, will that work? And then basically it works. And you just think, God, blimey, why don't I think of that? And something's happening in my business, and I'm starting to think a little bit about that. But there's a lot more about this story with our guest who's called, now listen, it's Etiosa Agbonlahor. And Etiosa, you're currently living in Tampa in Florida.
That's correct, Graham.
And is that where you're talking to us from right now?
That's where I'm talking to you from. I have lived all over the world, and I'm actually from New York is what I say, but been in Florida for a while now.
Beautiful place. I'm a big Florida fan. But Kevin, we've got a brilliant guest here about pricing. Kevin's the sort of accountant man. He just loves to add things up. Me on the other hand, I come up with these ideas of product ideas and so forth. And at the end of the day, I'm right now thinking about something that's my high ticket. When I, in the 80s, I worked for Lego, the toy company, and basically they always had a really, really high priced thing, and it always sold out. So I've got a sense of pricing from companies like that. And as I said, Dan Kennedy, but you're on a different level. Companies bring you in to sort of say, you've got it, presumably, you've got it all wrong. You've got to do it in a different way. Is that how it actually happens?
Usually it's, we're doing something different and we don't want to mess it up. So can you come and can you make sure, you know, we've got the number side down, we've got the quantitative side down, we've got some assumptions in like the demand estimation, what we think this could go for. We haven't really talked to customers quite yet. So can you come in, can you talk to customers, can you help us figure out how they are seeing this and the value they see in this thing? But then the more interesting part for us, my team, is can you then, using your understanding of how people make financial decisions, help us craft the prices around this? Should it end in 99? Should we compare to something more premium price? Should we have it as an annual subscription, right? How do we think about and actually package this up for customers? Mm. And so the fun part of what we do is bringing that psychology of how people make decisions around pricing, around purchasing, to bear on the pricing quant side of things.
Right. So, okay. You mentioned customers there. So presumably, do you sit around a table and talk to customers? Do you go out to see them and test? I don't know, you've got to be fairly careful about how you do that, I'm sure. But do you, I mean, is that the logic that you will see so many customers? And then you'll form a sort of an idea. Now, how do you pick the customer who's prepared to pay three or four times more than the other guy?
Well, we don't pick them, right? We get a good sample into the room.
Okay, I misspoke, but yeah.
But so let me walk you through the process, right? That maybe everything will fall into place that way. Mm. We have what we call the decision offer pricing framework. So the company I lead, pricing company, decision offer. And in that framework, we start with what we call mapping monetization zones. And that's essentially, what is the value that you offer that your customer also is willing to pay for? Right. Doesn't matter if you offer tremendous value and nobody wants to pay for it. You don't have a company, do you? You don't have a product. So what are those kind of aspects of value? Then we take them into the pricing research. And that's a mix of the quant side, you know, standard instruments that we have tweaked to make sure they're a little bit less subjective. And that helps us extricate, all right, this is the range at which will be optimal for you to price this at. Then we take that, of course, we wrap that with demand estimation and things like that. But then we take that into what we call the framing step, which is, all right, if we framed it using principles of loss aversion, for example, if we framed it as a decoy, if we showed one that's really more expensive compared to this price, or one that's super cheap compared to this price, what nudges more customers to want to choose this specific option, the way we've bundled it? And then back end of this, let's make sure you're always testing and growing and scaling your pricing. It shouldn't just be a one and done thing. every so often we say pricing should be a feature and not a reaction. A lot of times something changes in the environment, you know, inflation goes up, there's tariffs, I know everyone is panicking and trying to change their prices. Your pricing should be set in a way that's intentional so that you're constantly going back and saying, have we delivered more value and how do we make sure we are capturing that value we deliver? So that is the end-to-end framework. So the spot in which we are talking to customers is sort of in that second step. And the conversation with them is a mix of quantitative and qualitative. The quant being, for this level of value, right? Got a nice watch, it tells the time really well, but it also needs the battery changed every 2 years. For the fact that it's very efficient at telling the time, how much would you be willing to pay for at that? What do you value it at, right? That helps us go towards the value drivers and then the numbers around that. And so from that, if we're having those conversations and we start to realize, oh, there's different types of people. There's people like Etiosa who wants an analog watch that looks really nice with all the time well. And then there's other people who just want a digital watch that we get down to the specifics. Okay, we need to treat them differently and dive deeper. So to your question, it's less about let's find the people who are going to pay the most and more about let's step back end to end. This is the process. And as we're doing the research, if different kinds of camps emerge, let's treat them differently and dive into that.
Wow. I mean, it seems like a really involved process. You've spent an awful lot of time in education and things behind your shoulder there that basically say you never stop. I mean, that's presumably not a degree certificate, but it's basically just saying, yeah, well done.
Yeah, that's some volunteer work in Mexico is the bottom one. The top one is saying,
I'm trying to work out how somebody who just squanders a time all the time doing all these you do loads of things with your time. And what's going on? I mean, how do you clone yourself? I mean, you've got degrees from some very, very prestigious places. You've worked in some of, you know, in universities right around the world. You've got really intelligent people, PhDs, but they're not always the smartest people, let's face it. But basically, but they're pretty, pretty smart. And the thing about it is that they're being led by you. So you've managed to build a huge sort of reservoir of understanding about this specific area, this pricing area. What got you there in the first place?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question. So I spend most of my career in finance as a behavioral economist. And as I mentioned, behavioral economists, I basically study the psychology behind how people make financial decisions. So I worked with like big banks in Australia, helping them optimize, for example, helping people who are in early stage arrears get back on their feet faster, measuring financial well-being for the entire nation of Australia, just doing really interesting work. And then I moved back to the US to work with an investment firm. And there was a lot of, how do we help people save more, spend better? How do we help them diversify their assets? Well, building a new product, how do we think about positioning this, right? Should it be free? Should it cost this? Should it cost the other thing? How are people going to resonate with this at these different levels? And who are the people who we attract at these different levels? And when I got to the place of starting to think through building my own firm, it was important to me that I was solving an important problem, right? That's what's going to be sustainable from a business perspective. And me being a researcher, I wanted to talk to everybody. So I spent more than a year talking to all sorts of business owners who were successful, business owners who had failed, consultants, just everybody who I could think of, financial advisors, business bankers, just everybody. And every time I would mention behavioral economics, they're like, yeah, whatever, don't care. And pricing would come up and right away, it'd be like, ears perk up. That's really interesting. Some business owners would say to me, we're just copying competitors. We're not sure how to do it. I had a presentation when I started the business with a room full of women executives, and I asked them what comes up for them when they think about pricing. And it was words like fear, anxiety, dread, or guesstimating. And so all of that just kind of highlighted, like, this is a real issue. Mm-hmm. And it's not just because it's quantitative or numbers. It's also because a lot of our fears around a business gets reflected in the pricing. Right. If we're scared, people won't accept our price. If we're scared, we're not quite sure, you know, how it's all going to work. It just gets reflected in the pricing. And so there's a big psychological side to pricing. And so it was naturally, from my background, just interesting to me to want to step into that.
You're not going to reach out and sort of sway the sort of the problems that they have inside because, you know, you choose the wrong price for one of your higher ticket prices. And you've left a hell of a lot of money on the table. And that's probably, that keeps you up at night. I mean, that's the difference between a really good company and a takeoff company. How do you get into the mind of somebody who's going through that? I mean, is that something you deal with every day? Presumably it is.
It is. And the thing is, nobody thinks it's a mind issue, right? Everyone, first of all, everyone thinks it's a marketing issue. The price is okay. You haven't changed this in 2 years, but the price is okay. It's just marketing. We need to get the marketing right.
Right.
Let's talk about the price, and you might get more efficiencies from fixing that. But oftentimes, nobody comes in and says the issue is I'm scared, right? No one is going to admit that. But we step back and we start with, okay, how did you set the previous price? What went into it? How did you think about it? Right. What do you think this could be priced at? Well, I think it could be 50% more. Okay, why isn't it that? Well, if we raise it and everybody leaves and the market is so competitive now and the competitors and right, all of the kind of fears start to come out, and that allows us to start to unpack and go, okay, what are some baby steps we can take here? What does a test version look like? Maybe you raise the prices for newcomers, right? Maybe you don't change it for everybody. Maybe we do some analysis and see who's a legacy client who's been on the same price from 10 years ago. Let's talk about a glide path for them, right? But it really just starts by asking questions and letting people open up by themselves.
I find, Kevin, I mean, you're the sort of numbers man, but I mean, this is, I just like to dominate this bit, but you have to have a conversation here because you're a finance guy.
Yeah, because I leap in thinking, as soon as I think about price, I'm automatically thinking cost. And not necessarily, okay, you've got to have the cost of this thing plus a margin equals your price. But something that I've looked at a lot is, are you actually costing the thing properly? Do you really know what it costs you to produce it? And I know psychologically we have a tendency to overcost the simple and undercost the complex. Okay. And I would certainly a process I've taken a lot of clients through that have got a portfolio of services is making sure that they understand the cost of delivering those services, what drives the cost. Because often you'll find across a portfolio of things, you've underpriced some bits and you've overpriced others. And you want to eliminate the cross subsidy because that can be very, very dangerous. Particularly, one client I remember doing that with was in the our own NHS, where they were selling a service into the NHS internal market. And they'd overpriced one or two things and they were losing bids on them because they were too expensive. They were winning a load of work on some other stuff that was very keenly priced. And we made a discovery that actually this was very dangerous because the stuff that was very highly priced was actually subsidizing some of the stuff that was cheap. And hey, we've got to sort the pricing out of these things. Otherwise, we're going to lose all the profitable business and be left with the rubbish.
I'm currently reading I'm not the it's called The Strategy of Pricing. I'm not sure. It's a classic textbook, and the first kind of half, two-thirds of it is all about cost and making sure you get that right. I'm curious, I know this is me supposed to be answering questions, but I'm curious when you talk to clients about there's a difference between a fixed cost, right? This is you're always going to incur this is always going to happen, versus the additional cost of selling ever incremental product. Do they understand that as a concept? Because when I try to introduce that as, yes, we want to talk about introducing a new price, we're going to do the research, but pretend the fixed costs, they're just always going to be there. It's kind of sunk cost for now. Let's look at for every additional thing that you sell here, how could it be pulling more of us with? Does that resonate with people?
Yeah.
I don't I, it, I think it stretches into different things. We have a bank over here in the UK called First Direct, and one of the guys who set it up was I used to work with because when they were setting up, I was dealing with them. And basically, one of the things he said to me is, "Oh, it's a bit like, well, if I can get one product, then fine. But you know, at four products, they're yours forever." Now, basically, that probably gives you some latitude in terms of price that you wouldn't have otherwise have had. So I think there's probably a linkage between what do you call it, loyalty, but basically the number of products you have with a company that then gives you, and I'm sure this has come up several times with you, but basically Peter, who helped set this First Direct up, recognized that that was one of the factors that they were driving towards, and they created, well, I don't know, you might not have heard of it, but basically it is one of the best banks in this country. I mean, it was a non-branch bank. It was a telephone bank. They had supreme levels of service, and it makes it so much easier when you've got that great fixed cost grounding, the way in which you're working with somebody, that is so much easier to throw another couple of products in there, and then you're never going to leave. And I think that then gives you a chance to boost your prices. But what I say, I haven't found that process that easy for my business to do, but I'm working on exactly that right now, Etio, so that I am trying to, well, lots of different products within my company. I've got AI products in it, as well as things like direct mail and data and so forth. And I wanted to put several of these things together as an ultimate, in my case, lead generation package. And I know instinctively it's probably going to be 4 or 5 times bigger than any other sale that I've made. Any. And I know instinctively that maybe 1 out of 30 companies that we approach might be interested, not the sort of maybe 10 or 20 out of 30. So there is this issue that I'm facing, that how high should or could it be? I don't think I'm talking to anybody better. I couldn't talk to anybody better than you to answer the question. Is there a sort of level that at some stage that it becomes just not viable? Or is there something that you have to build into your offer that makes it stretchable? I don't know.
I think that there's always budget for the right solution, right? I will pay whatever to solve the problem. The question then becomes, with this product, have you done the research to the kinds of people you want to sell into to understand, do they value the different elements, the AI, all of the different elements that you're bringing to them? How do they value that? The other thing that's important here, and this is a behavioral economics or standard economics concept, is reference points, right? What else are they currently using to solve the problem that your product is going to solve? And what is the cost for every single one of those things that they're using to solve it? When you look at that in aggregate, is your pricing an improvement over that? That's just on the quantitative side. Is there a qualitative side as well to having to manage six different things versus one simple streamlined thing? Is it employees who are managing those six different things? What is the number of hours that they use? Could you back that out? So there are simple kind of tractable ways to understand what is my product going to be referred to internally? What is the reference points for that? And can I shift the reference points? If, for example, your product replaces a suite of six other very expensive things, maybe that's what you're comparing it to. Hey, instead of doing the six things, use my product. It costs 50% less, right? If instead your product is replacing the time of a highly skilled employee, it might be, hey, instead of paying £100,000 to this mid-level employee to do this work, the product costs XYZ and it's a savings of blah, 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 right? So thinking about what you compare it to is the first one. That's the kind of first step. And then you can also then think through how do you frame it up? Is it a single product? Are there tiers that you can bake in? Is it a subscription-based? Kind of there's ways to play around with that as well. But most important thing is talk to customers, understand how do they value this. And when you're having that conversation with them, what are they currently using to solve the problems that your product solves, right? And what does it cost them? And that starts to give you a sense of what could we do with this?
It is part of that discussion would be, in my particular case, part of that discussion would be to do with the result, the success they're getting from these other solutions, because it's a bit like in the kingdom of the blind, the one-eyed man's king. And at the end of the day, this the solutions that they might be not suffering from, but using as on a repeatable basis. Along comes a different guy. It's the classic sort of, don't bother me, you're selling a Tommy gun, don't bother them, we've got a war to fight, and they're using bow and arrows. So the whole idea, it seems to me, that AI is giving us an opportunity to change the dynamic in the way in which some people do lead generation. One little example is built into the services. I talked to my colleagues about this, that basically I once was employed by somebody to figure out why they weren't getting the kind of results they were getting. And I did some analysis of their data. And shall we say, it was pointing at 1 o'clock and it should have been pointing at 2 o'clock. So just by orientating the data towards the right kind of where the place where their clients really lived or really were, they were just going to naturally find more people. And so that kind of logical, and we do that with an AI workflow, so an ICP and an initial customer profile, a value proposition, a customer first offer. And then what we would do is take all of that and more and basically create creatives. And then we would use a customer simulator based on the ICP and say, hey, what do you think to this? How much would you pay for this? Now, that's not necessarily doing the level of detail that you would have, but it's remarkable just how much detail it could give you as if you can train the customer simulator to act like your ideal customer. And I think that's one of the things that we're doing. So that for me, that's the 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock change. It's an orientation, a direction of travel. If I'm traveling in the right direction and all my clients are there at two instead of one, I'm going to make more sales. So that's the kind of logic I'm using. That's just one part of it. There's others, but basically, I'm trying to figure out it might be a new thing that replaces something that's been suboptimal.
Yes, the interesting part with that is going to be the assurance of data quality going in, because the one thing AI will do is drive confidence in results and output. And so everyone is going to be like, let's make sure that what we're feeding it is the right thing. And
Sure.
maybe that is the value prop, is here is why our data that we've trained this model on is the most robust, the most amazing, the most we've done all the work and we've hand verified everything or something, right? But then what you've described could easily be replacing two or three different teams, right? The UXR team, it could be replacing, even the creative team, it could be replacing your copywriters, your marketing teams. What does it cost to have, even if it was just two people from every single one of those teams doing this work, what could a project like that look like? And what does your AI with the automation now, what does that cost savings rate? So that would be how I'd think about it at a strategic
She's a remarkable young lady. I mean, everybody's young to her compared to me and Kevin, you know, by the way. But you that was a brilliant answer, Kevin.
Edgenosa, isn't there something that says, particularly if you talk about these sort of AI applications, they're going to become commoditized very, very quickly. So if you've put a price together that's based on the value to the customer, and the saving to the customer is obvious in terms of all those people he could replace and so on, isn't there a very quick downhill path? Once other companies realize, oh, there's a big margin here, they'll come in and undercut, and then somebody else will undercut them, and so on and so forth, till you're down to a pretty low, pretty ordinary price again.
Well, it depends on differentiation, right? Who is the specific niche that you're targeting? I talk to people about understanding what room they want to be in. So, for example, if you as a customer, you go to a bazaar, you expect they're going to stand up, you're going to haggle, you're going to be treated the same way as everybody else. Same person, you go to a high-end store like I would say Nordstrom here, I don't know, Bergdorf, Harrods, whatever the high-end stores are down there. You're sat down, you've had a cup of water or coffee or whatever, and then the things are brought to you, and there's not expectations that you're going to haggle, right? It depends on what room you're in. When we go into a room, for example, we say we're pricing consultants, we bring a behavioral economics bent to this, we're staffed by behavioral economics. So when people go to compare us and say, okay, what is the reference point for the work that Tiosa does? Who else are we comparing her to? There's a lot of people who do what we do. If Graham, you're saying, well, our lead generation is very specifically for lawyers who deal with a high volume of divorce cases that are making this up, right?
Oh, you just researched my daughter. She got another citation in was it the top 100? She told us the other day,
Oh,
second. So she went straight into her
fantastic.
boss and asked for a pay rise. So that's how that works. Sorry,
Right.
that's it. But yes, she's in that field.
But yes, this is the niche that we serve. And then when you're talking to the customer, it's Here is how we validated the data. Here's how we've made sure it's specific to your niche. We've talked in the US, we've talked about all of the SSE compliance regulations. We've built all of that into this because we're talking to the people who understand us and see us. There's not other people they might compare it to. So I think differentiation plays a big role in that as well. It's not just, well, the best price for everybody, let's go. It's also thinking through what room do we want to be in and how do we position our frame ourselves as well.
If it was just one part, you know, if it's just one bit of AI, then I would be, you know, less. But there are other things, and you know, but in one tiny thing is actually creating a book for people, because part and I'm trying to think through all the things I've come across over the last so many years doing these things, and you know, the authority from a book is something that is genuinely likely to make a difference in their relationship with their end client. My clients tend to be high net worth individuals, so therefore that particular niche is where we're headed. Anyway, enough about me and what might happen in the next few months. What you've been doing is you've been just jetting around the world, and people get you in, and as I said, you do make a difference. But is there some are there some stats that says out of 10 customers, this is where they were? Now this is where they are. Now you might be not able to sort of declare them because of NDAs and all that. But is there a sort of a rule of thumb that you can actually add so much more to a Dan Kennedy-esque, more to their pricing? His might be much more finger in the air, but yours is based on behavioral stats to and you've got data scientists who are some of the smartest people around. They basically, well, some of them, but
Right.
you deal with them. But I had to make up for the PhD comment, but I've met a few. But the thing is, you is there some sort of factor that you bring to a pricing?
Well, there is research from, you know, Harvard Business School ran this research that showed a 1% price increase could drive as much as 11% downstream profit increase. Considering, you know, operations, taxes, all of those things. So that's kind of the field in which we're playing. But we've had clients where we didn't change their price. We didn't fix it. We just said, let's change how we present the price to your customers. So an ed tech company came to us and said, we've always sold directly into schools. We want to sell our product directly to the parents now. We know what the school's pricing looks like. We're comfortable with that. Never sold to parents. Not quite sure how to do it. How do we think about this? And just taking the pricing that they had in mind, they weren't quite yet ready to change their prices and reframe it. For example, they had it on a monthly subscription because everybody does a monthly subscription. And we said, this is a product that's priced enough that it makes sense to do an annual subscription because in behavioral science, we talk about the pain of paying, right? So every time you see money leave your account or back, anytime you spend cash, you swipe your card, there's a little bit of like this utility that comes with that, right? So your client is seeing this, your name on their bill every single month. You're kind of serving as a reminder that you're taking this money out, but you're low price enough that it could be an annual subscription once a month. You drive down that pain of paying, right? Oh, I don't know how that.
You've just given yourself a thumbs up. For those people watching on YouTube, you've seen that, but anybody else.
But yes, so making changes like that, for example, let's reduce the let's bring more cognitive ease into the way we describe these things. They only had one product. We said, can you separate this out into different tiers? And let's think through what is the most kind of premium version of this? What does that look like? If we want people to be able to come in and experience the product without giving it to them for free, what does that pathway look like? And then what is the preferred option we want people to take? What is actually the tier we expect most people are going to take? Let's recreate some packages for you in that way. And they found that most 9 out of 10 new clients coming in choose that preferred tier, which of course was a more profitable tier for them. So that's kind of the power of just the behavioral economics of this, of the framing, of the psychology bringing that in. And in that case, we didn't even have them change their prices or anything. We said, let's just take what you have and let's reframe it.
It on an annual basis, and presumably might have ended up selling more because they didn't have that pain of seeing those prices all the way through. I completely understand that. I've never been a big subscription fan, but it does work for people. But
Subscriptions are a very interesting thing, though, Graham. And sitting in a subscription business, I'm interested to hear what's Etioza said there, the idea of the annual subscription being better than the monthly, I'd partially actually disagree with that, because we've got members who will pay every month and have possibly been members for 2, 3 years. We have other members who will pay annually, and chances are the more likely ones to get the support ticket to say, "Oh, please cancel my subscription," will be the ones that have just seen the annual renewal go through their bank account and say, "Oh, that's a lot of money." Where the ones that see the 10% of that price go through every month don't have the same reaction.
Yes. So that's why I was caveating very heavily around this was a low price product.
Yeah.
The same way you don't want to see the cup of coffee going out every single month. It makes more sense to see, even when we bundle it in aggregate, that annual price is still low enough that it's not really going to trigger a sense of, let me reevaluate what value I'm getting for this product and if I want to continue it. So all of this, there are no silver bullets. All of this is grounded in what is the research that's specific to your company, specific to your clients, and how they engage with the product and how they're going to think about it.
Yeah. I do love some of the psychology around this. I remember spending quite a bit of time around, how do you describe your price point on a website? One it and being told, well, it's only the first digit in the number that people ever look at. So, a price of 375 to the customer is the same as a price of 395, but is a lot lower than a price of 400.
That's called charm pricing. And that actually only, again, nuances it. It works in specific contexts. It was if you, it works really well for low price products, utilitarian products, products that people consider are kind of interchangeable, right? When people see that 0.99, 0.97 ending, it's almost like you're signaling everything here is going to be discounted or of good economic value to you. And yes, what the brain is doing is rounding down rather than rounding up. So $3.99 might sell a lot more than $4 because the brain sees it as three and not as four. That said, if you're offering a premium product, you know, it's higher price, it's based on trust or transparency, you actually want to use flat numbers, round numbers, 800, 1200, you know, those kind of transparent numbers or round numbers kind of indicate more transparency, more fairness, and they're better for premium products. So it's one of those things where there's a nuance there, even if the signs are is back in one thing or another. The other thing that's interesting with subscriptions is I think that we're seeing that more people now are having what we're calling subscription fatigue, right? And now there's products you can subscribe to that help you cancel the subscriptions you already have.
Yeah, I've seen
And
that.
so I think there's a little bit of a groundswell of people having a kind of an allergic reaction to don't I know before we're all on board to set it and forget it, but like now there's a little bit more, at least what we're seeing here is people paying closer attention to. I would rather pay a flat fee than like subscribe. I don't want to see money coming out every month. So that's just something interesting. We're still kind of wanting to dig deeper into that.
And I can think of a particular area where I'm very much definitely in that mindset. It's photography type software. I think of the leader, Adobe Photoshop, very much it's a very expensive monthly subscription. And instead, and Graham and I both use the same product. We use Affinity Photo instead, which is a one-off purchase price. And you've bought it, you've got it. And I, for something that's nice to have, but I don't use that often, I'd much rather have that pricing model.
Yeah, I've just been using the Affinity for another reason. But but going back to when you wander into a big business, the marketing manager is probably bristling. He's probably thinking, "Oh goodness, I'm going to be second guessed about what I've done over the last 5 years." And in comes this young whippersnapper, and she's bright as heck, and she's going to tell me that I've got it all wrong in front of the boss. Isn't that what happens?
No, definitely not.
No, it's all right then.
I know the goal is to make friends with everybody.
Okay.
corporate background. I do think, though, to the point you're making, it's important that Sales is on board. Marketing is able to frame things the right way. The finance team is talking. The product teams, who actually usually have the remit to do the customer research, are also in the room. Because what often happens is with companies is we've got the price and strategy. It's fantastic. It's in a memo somewhere. But then we've given our sales team a leeway to follow or to pursue sales velocity instead, right? Just sell as much as possible. And so in the bid to sell as much as possible, we're no longer looking at, well, what's actually profitable? How many discounts can we possibly give here? What is the range of discounts I can offer, right? So sales starts doing its own thing because they've got their own goals, and marketing is doing its own thing over here. And then products is building this thing that I think is great. And UXR is standing there frustrated because no one is listening to what the customer says. Some of the value of having us in the room is that we bring everybody into the same place and let's have a holistic conversation and make sure we're aligned. We've done work in the past where the final deliverable wasn't even like, here's a report. It was, and we're going to talk to the sales team and have a workshop with them and walk them through this because they are that last mile. They are the actual delivery agents for this and make sure everybody is on board. No, we try to make friends and make sure everyone is singing the same.
I can't imagine anybody taking issue with you, but having said that, well, it just seems to me a fairly natural reaction for somebody to defend the decision that they may have made before. But that said, if you walk out of there after a few months and you know you look back with pride and you think, I've just made them so many more millions on the bottom line, and they are as happy as a sandboy, and they then come back and rebook you for, I don't know. Are you on retainer? Is it something that you, is that your model, or is it just we'll do a project, done, in and out? How does it work?
We are more project-based. We do the project. And then, of course, we're still in touch with our clients. And, now and then we'll touch base, have a conversation. Sometimes, if we have a project that's not going to start because the company has one or two things to sort out first, we will do a bit of a retainer as a way of getting in the room, making friends, doing some, presentations, talking to people, getting everyone on the same team first, and then doing the work. But generally, we are more project-based.
That's interesting. And I had a client this morning who suggested it was a mailing, and basically they had they wanted to move from a, sorry, very boring, but a C5 envelope to an A, sorry, a C4 envelope, which is like a big like an A4 piece of paper, and it's vastly more expensive because Royal Mail can't sol they can't sol sort it with machines, so the price is high. I mean, when they took a look at the price, it's like, well, the client's not going to do this. Well, I told you. It's a bit like, well, don't do that damn silly thing in the first place. But everybody in the meantime is scrabbling around trying to give them an option. But anyway, these things happen. Pricing happens every day. You probably, I've been, from the Dan Kennedy School, I'm always worried that I've got the lower price. I've got my price is too low, and I'd rather have fewer clients and a higher price. I just would. But I don't know if that's the smartest decision, but I just would.
There is that other flip side on price, though, that you've just mentioned, the Royal Mail one. No, price the envelope high so that people don't use it. It's a very, very interesting little tool, that one.
Well, no, the client himself, the end client, I haven't spoken to, but basically I know his dialogue, but he was, and I think he's got every reason to believe that the mailing coming to his market in that larger envelope might just have a better response, and that's when it's worth him taking the punt on the higher price, because basically he might have just got himself. So basically, we can quite easily get him back into a more acceptable machine ready kind of option, but he might be onto something, and so therefore swallow it and then learn for next time. But I don't know. I just find it all quite frustrating. Pricing is, you obviously love it. Every day you come to work and you're thinking about prices.
And then go home and read textbooks about pricing. Yes.
You must be great fun at parties then. I mean, what do people ask? So I've got this watch. What would you say? I mean, how do you get out of that when you're not being you, the pricing maven, or whatever you want to, what's your nickname in the pricing world?
I don't have a nickname in the
Oh,
pricing
we'll
world.
create one then. We'll definitely create one now, though, I'm sure.
I like the pricing maven. That's good.
But once you're not that for a minute and you're off doing things that you enjoy as well, what would that be?
So I invest in real estate. I have a big real estate kind of community down here in the States. And so I actually have a real estate podcast. At least I will have it for the next couple of months. So making decisions about if I'm going to sunset it or not. And so I get to talk to really interesting real estate investors around the world, just doing from people who like have one tiny unit to people who have like 300 units and doing crazy things in the real estate world, and people who have been investing for 50 years, 60 years, people who,
Wow.
you know, just really, I get to learn a lot from them. So I really like that. I also volunteer with a charity doing financial counseling. And so it's amazing to have, you know, a couple come in and say, like, this is the last thing we're going to try. And if it doesn't work, that's it, we're done. And
Yeah.
watch them over months just slowly transform and turn back to each other and create processes and rhythm to make their relationship sustainable and get back on board with the financial part of things. So I love financial counseling. I love that side of the world. And that's kind of what I do when I'm not in the pricing stage of things. I did want to comment on that Royal Mail thing, though, the pricing to put people off. So that's the decoy pricing. And sometimes people will do that to, you know, we want people to very seriously consider this middle package that we have, but it looks quite expensive to them now. And so we create an option that's, you know, in economics, asymmetrically dominated, meaning when you compare it across things, it just looks like, why would I buy this? But it's more expensive and it's so high enough that people go, maybe not that one. Let's take a look at the other option. And that's the option you actually want them to use. So that, what is it, the C5 envelope?
Yeah, the C5's a bit like an A4 folded in half, and
Maybe
the
that
A4 is
is
the
it.
A4.
And the number of times you see that tactic on a website, Edeoza, the three columns, there's the cheap offer, the starter, and then you look down the list of features and you say, oh, I need that and it hasn't got it. I need that and it hasn't got it. I need that and it hasn't got it. So there's this cheap one, and psychologically straight away you pushed up and that's not good enough. And then they put this really expensive one in as well, the decoy that they've probably never ever sold any of, but it has the effect of making people think the one in the middle is great value.
Yeah.
I
I
had
think, I
a
don't know
couple.
if you've come across Elon Musk's Tesla Model Y. I've driven one for about three and a half years, so I'm coming up to replacing it with a new version of it. I love the car, and the new version had just so many bells and whistles. But that's the one in the middle. That's the and the new version came out, which is a performance version. So that like gets there before you've even thought of getting there. So it's really, really quick. But and that's relatively so much more money. And it's like you're thinking, I'm gravitating to, I really want the best, you know. And you know, but the middle one, well, it works and it's just great and it's still pretty quick. It's just that I don't know. He did me last time because we bought the first one, and then he lowered his price, and the value was about 10-15% of the value just went like that. So, but I'm still loyal. But sorry.
I'm always suspicious, particularly when you're looking at cars, at going for that really top of the range model with all the bells and whistles on, because that always seems to be the one that the price for the residual value falls disproportionately when it comes to trading it in. You never get that
No.
extra premium back.
No.
But sometimes what you're buying is the experience, right?
Oh, for sure.
Sure.
The little known fact is that when I worked at Royal Mail for a few years, about 11 years, and I was in a senior management, and basically I got this car, and I think it was the car that broke the company car policy. It was like I expect it to, you know, because I could, why not? And then there wasn't any more company cars. Everything was what it was, one of
Right, that
these,
sucks.
you know, salary sacrifice or whatever it was. And but I got this car. It was unbelievably nice. Leather this and fast that. And but you know, you wouldn't think a public body like the Royal Mail would have cars like that, but they did. Anyway, so sorry, I'm boring you with Royal Mail stories, but pricing is such a fascinating area. You're going to stick with this for the rest of your natural, aren't you?
We'll see. We'll see. We're definitely going to stick with it for a good long while, and then we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Well, Etiosa, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the Next 100 Days podcast. Thank you for joining Kevin and I.
Grant, pricing is certainly something I've always been fascinated with and the psychology around it. And as an accountant, to start off with, it was all cost for me and then making a profit on top of the cost. But I discovered something really interesting about pricing in my early part of my career at ICI when I was business accountant for the European plastics business. One of our product groups was making the polymer that goes into your classic 2 liter lemonade, Coca-Cola bottle, and so on, PET. And one of the nice things about PET is it has supremely good optical qualities. You probably don't really appreciate what it can do just from your Coca-Cola bottle. And our sales team got talking at the time to some cosmetics manufacturers. And cosmetics generally came in quite small, but quite thick, high quality glass bottles. Lovely stuff. But their challenge was, well, what we've got here per sort of ounce of product, we've got a lot of weight. And one of the markets we really want to crack is duty free on airplanes. So we said, well, actually, sure, we can develop a plastic that's going to go and make a bottle of equivalent quality. We knew we could. That was the thing. We knew that the product we already had would make the bottles they wanted. We came up and said, right, we'll develop a cosmetics grade PET for you. A few weeks later, went back to the customer and said, oh, we've developed this polymer. Do you want to try this? We've got one of, we've been in the semi-tech plant, we've molded a couple of bottles. What do you think? And we ended up putting this together as standard PET going into lemonade bottles and things like that was sold about £1,000 a ton of polymer. We priced the cosmetics grade £3,000 per ton of polymer. What we never told the customer was, had we done any development work? Had we built a new polymer for? No, we hadn't. We'd just given the same polymer that went into lemonade bottles a different name. Sold it for three times the price.
Well, there's lots of smart people around, and we've been very, very fortunate to have one of them on our show today. And pricing is difficult. It's not just about a number. There's so many different factors. As you said, you might have looked at that story was more about a market acceptability, sort of a pricing value.
It was about the
And
value. They could put more
but you
cosmetics.
started by saying that
Airplane.
you were talking about cost
Yeah.
and cost plus. You just think, well, you've got to be in a particular market for that to work for you, as if there's literally no other way of actually increasing the value to the customer. But in most cases, a value-added pricing strategy, well researched and so forth, is probably a smarter idea. And that's the dilemma I've got with this other new product that I'm doing. And I think that's what I'll be sure to look at Etios's
I'd
website.
say to people who are, developing a high-end product, looking at the cost, increased cost, therefore increased price, very careful because the human brain does have a tendency to overcost the simple and undercost the complex. And that lovely premium product that you put out at a premium price, just wait for your profits start to fall as you sell more of it because it's dragging in more customer service calls and all those hidden things.
No, I understand there's a challenge with it, but I'm quietly confident that and Kevin, we're not surrounded by equally, what's the right word? Not everybody has the same set of things that I do in this company, and I'm just thinking, well, right, okay, let's just make the most of all of them. But anyway, we'll talk about that another time in detail. But for now, I've been Graham Arrowsmith.
I've been Kevin Appleby. Goodbye.
Goodbye.